يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Welcome back to Middle East Analysis, first Middle East Analysis in a couple of months, which is why you're listening to a two-parter. In fact, I sincerely hope you are. We're joined by Dr. Harry Hagopian, our consultant on the Middle East North Africa region. And we just finished talking, obviously, about Syria, but also about that little statelet Bahrain and the very different realities being faced there. Harry, we move on to Egypt. And again, as you said in your focal points, there are a few things to talk about here. Presidential elections, interesting women's rights issues. Indeed. I think you're going to talk to us about. So I'm going to leave it to you to actually plot through Egypt.
Egypt is very interesting because what happens in Egypt inevitably affects the whole of the Middle East and North Africa, the whole of the Arab world in some sense. It has been the father of Arabism over decades, and now people look at Egypt to see what happens there and how it will provide stability for the rest of the region, or be at least a leader for the rest of the region. At the moment, there are so many confusing signals, James, that are coming out of Egypt. We have discussed Egypt in the past. We have talked about Christian, Coptic communities there, and how they feel in the wake of the revolution of 25 January of last year. We've also talked about the various elections that have taken place for parliament, the two houses. What at the moment is happening in Egypt is that they are all getting ready for presidential elections. And presidential elections, which will take place in two rounds in May and June, have also highlighted the problems that Egypt is facing politically in terms of a confrontation between the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, SCAF, and Parliament, which is largely dominated by Sunni Muslim parties, largely the Muslim Brotherhood, and also the Salafist Al-Nur and other parties. Now, in a sense, one thing is the election, the presidential election. The other one, which I think is very, very important, is also the writing of the constitution. A new constitution is being written for the country. And those two I would like to focus on before I say a couple of words on women's rights in Egypt as well. Because in terms of the presidential elections, some of the contenders, which were very high-profile contenders, both Islamist and non-Islamist, have been disqualified by a body that has actually got the judicial authority to decide who will be able to run in those elections or not. And at the moment, we've got, I think two candidates who I would suspect at this stage at least are leading in the race. One is Amr Moussa, a former Secretary General of the Arab League, and the other one is Abul Futur, who is what is known, and it is an inaccurate description, but you forgive me if I use it too because it avoids us going into too many technical details, is a moderate Muslim from the Muslim Brotherhood, who actually was expelled from the Muslim Brotherhood for his moderate views. Now he's running in the elections and is being re-accepted so that he is the face of moderate Islam versus a more secular liberal candidate, Amr Moussa. So I think at the end, those two are at the moment leading the pack, but there are others as well who are running in those elections. You want to say something? I can see the eyebrows raising.
Am I itching to get in there? The only question I wanted to ask is which of those two realities, either more moderate Muslim reality versus a more secular reality, which of those would be better, do you think, for the Coptic Christian community?
A very good question. A very, very good question, and a difficult question to answer because I wouldn't be able to tell you which one would be better for the Coptic community because the Copts have faced enormous problems during former President Hosni Mubarak's time, and he was anything but a Muslim or Islamist leader. So who says that they will be in far worse or far better position if a Muslim contender becomes president and he draws his source of authority and erudition from Islam? So it's very difficult to do that. But I will answer you, James, somewhat differently by saying that Amr Moussa, who is I think in his mid-70s, is someone who is associated with the former regime. He was foreign minister during Hosni Mubarak's time, before becoming a secretary general of the Arab League. In a sense, he is secular, he is liberal. Would he be able to implement the policies and the plans that he has in mind when we know that parliament is predominantly Muslim, run or controlled at least by the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafist parties? In a sense, I know Amr Moussa, I respect him enormously. If he wins, I'm not going to lose much sleep that night, but I would wonder how much authority he would have versus parliament, versus the government, versus the military council to implement his plans. On the other hand, the Muslim contender, Abul Futuh, is, in my opinion, a moderate Muslim, and one whose pronouncements to date have been quite open-minded and flexible. So if you put me in a difficult situation that I need to choose one or the other...
I thought you were going to say headlock.
Perhaps you would be surprised to say that I would go for Abul Futuh as being probably the better candidate for the moment in Egypt. It doesn't mean that Amr Moussa is not. It means that both of them, in some sense, will not make me lose sleep at night. Now, the reason I say this is manifold. On the one hand, it is the express views of this man, but also the fact that he hails from the Muslim Brotherhood, who control parliament. Therefore, it might be easier for him to be able to cooperate with parliament in a less confrontational and more consensual manner than would a liberal coming from the liberal end of the political stream in Egypt. Would that work or not? I don't know. Time will tell. And for all I know, when we have another podcast in a month or so, when we're discussing the outcome of those elections, I might actually give you a different viewpoint, because the charming thing about the Middle East and North Africa, for a lack of another word, is that things change every day, and you've got to be on the ball all the time, because what I said yesterday wouldn't necessarily apply today, and what I'm telling you now might not apply tomorrow. So in that sense, I would qualify my answer by saying the two leading contenders at the moment do not give me any particular nightmares. But what does give me nightmares is the drafting of the constitution. Because what happened is that there was an attempt by parliament, predominantly by the Muslim Brotherhood, political arm of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafist parties, to basically create a constituent assembly which was supposed to oversee the drafting of the constitution, which was predominantly 70% of the members of that 100-member constituent assembly were from Islamic or Islamist sources. Now, the reasoning given for that was that Parliament said, well, we are predominantly the elected people or deputies of this country, so we should have a majority on this assembly. I would beg to differ by saying that ruling a country, or who is in Parliament, take our own Parliament at Westminster here. One day it's the Tories, one day it's Labour. Hey-ho, today it's even the Lib Dems. But in that sense, who rules the country is a product of fair and free elections, hopefully. The constitution is not supposed to reflect the platform or the agenda of the ruling party of the moment. It's supposed to be for the whole country. So you have to have a blend of liberals, Muslims, different people with different political thought, Christians, others, so that the constitution would be for all Egyptians and not only for one party, even though that party at the moment predominates.
Now, clearly that is something we should perhaps even dedicate a podcast to, when we can actually analyze,
I think so,
what's put in front of us. But let's talk about women's rights very quickly.
Women's rights, yeah, that's one of the most important things. And women's rights has been very much, if you go in on Facebook, if you look at the blogs on the internet, you will see one after the other, there are loads and loads of discussions, even some of them very vituperative discussions about what is happening in Egypt. And the reason is, to some extent, not entirely, that there is a rising star in Egypt, an American-Egyptian young woman by the name of Munal Tahawi, who wrote a long article in Foreign Policy magazine recently, which was entitled rather provocatively, Why Do They Hate Us? And by that she meant, why do Egyptian men hate Egyptian women? And of course, it's like throwing a pigeon amongst the cats, because it created so much arguments, discussions, conversations, some people saying you're absolutely right, some people saying no, it's not right. And what she was trying to do is to say that there is an inbred sense of misogyny within Egyptian culture, drawing on different sources, not least on all those young women across months and months who demonstrated in Tahrir Square, in Muhammad Mahmoud Street, in Suez and Alexandria, etc., against the regime. We have those stories. Do you remember there was a famous story in all the news channels about a woman wearing a blue bra, and there were those army people who were thumping her with their boots? And she uses that as an example of this misogynistic attitude that men have toward women, and what should happen in order to free men from those prejudices and to restore equality between men and women. Now, the discourse continues. I've heard many, many opinions for or against. I've spoken with some of these women. One of the icons of Arab women's academia is Professor Laila Ahmed, who spoke about it. She commended the article, but with reservations. And of course, there are men who feel that this is entirely inappropriate or untrue. I actually applaud her efforts. I applaud the fact that she's removed the lid and that all this is coming out. However, I would say that we have to be cautious, because reading her article implies that there is a homogeneity of misogynistic attitudes across the whole Arab world against women, which I beg very, very sincerely and forcefully to disagree with. It's not the same in Saudi as in Egypt. It's not the same in Egypt as in Jordan or Palestine. And secondly, we should avoid using provocative language when talking about a subject that in itself is so fragile and sensitive.
We're getting towards the end now, and I'd like to talk about something that, if you were mentioning the Middle East, would be the first point on the agenda. It would dominate. It would, you'd start looking at the political parties and people and statesmen, stateswomen in the West and how they want to influence it. Israel-Palestine.
Oh, yes.
But we don't talk about it anymore.
Israel-Palestine.
Where are we at?
Yeah, Israel-Palestine, James. You've said something very interesting, because the poor Palestinians, if I may say so without in any way sounding condescending, I hope, is that their conflict, which was at the epicenter of the whole political imagination of an Arab world, has somehow been lost by the fact that there are so many other issues that are out there making the headlines, that people are not only talking about Israel-Palestine. When people are talking about the dreadful killings in Syria, the clashes in Bahrain, the virulent tensions in Egypt, the tribal repositioning in Libya and what that means for an oil-producing country, when we're talking about what is the future of other countries across the Middle East and North Africa, Israel-Palestine somehow becomes less the hub and it turns into one of the hubs. However, I would still think that Palestine is very much part of the political imagination of the Arab world. And interestingly enough, you asked me this question perhaps unknowingly, James, as we remember this week, this month, the 10th anniversary of the Arab Peace Initiative, which was basically all the Arab countries through the League of Arab States said to Israel, we are willing to recognize you, we are willing to normalize relations with you, if and only if you return the occupied territories and we resolve the Israeli-Arab conflict. Interestingly enough, now in Israel, where there are mooted to be general elections soon, perhaps as close as in August or in autumn, there are Israeli leading public figures, politicians and former Shin Bet intelligence officers, who are actually saying that the whole character, the Jewish nature of the State of Israel and the whole concept of democracy as we understand it in Israel are being threatened by this very right-wing cantankerous Israeli policy that the government is presently pursuing. So in all of this, there is a little bit of a hiatus as to what we do with Israel-Palestine. Now, the Palestinians are trying in their own way to counter that, to counter the creation of new outposts which are illegal under international law, the expansion of existing settlements. More to the point, the uprooting of olive trees. I was talking to one of our leading archbishops in the Conference of Bishops here in England and Wales, who is not only an authority on parts of the region, but also a foremost theologian, who was asking me, Harry, what's happening in Salfit, a West Bank village where olive trees are being uprooted. This is part and parcel of what is increasing the bitterness and making the resolution of this conflict so much more difficult. But there is a consensus. There is a consensus emerging within Palestinian political thinking that what they should do now, when they are not at the forefront of every single political development in that part of the world, is one, that they should basically focus on how does the quartet help in a way that the United States doesn't obstruct its efforts, its Irenic efforts to find a solution. Secondly, I think, how would they address the question of international legitimacy, in other words, the illegitimacy of occupation through the United Nations institutions? And finally, something that is coming up is nonviolent civil resistance or disobedience. This is something that is also coming up as one way in Palestine to oppose the occupation. How is it going to move forward? Is it going to happen or not? I don't know. The political establishment in Israel promises one thing, delivers something else. Prime Minister Netanyahu havers and equivocates quite consistently. So the situation there is also bad. The Palestinians also need to be in our prayers and in our thoughts, because at the very end of the day, if you ask every Tunisian, every Libyan, every Egyptian, every Syrian, every Jordanian, everybody in that region, whether they're paying lip service or being sincere about it, they realize that Palestine is the key to the whole region and therefore to peace in that region once the dust begins to settle, whenever it does settle.
Now, Harry, I'm going to risk it here, because usually when I throw the mic open for a final thought from you, I'm not directive at all. I let you pick whatever's on your mind at that given time. But, you know, Hagopian, good Armenian name. Obviously, we've just commemorated the 97th, I believe, anniversary of the Armenian genocide. And I'd just like to get your thoughts on that.
Thank you, James. Yes, I am Armenian, and it means a lot for me, the Armenian genocide, because my grandparents and relatives hail from eastern Turkey, where they fled the country during the Armenian genocide in 1915 under cover of World War I. Armenians the world over, and there are more Armenians in the diaspora than there are in the independent Republic of Armenia in the southern Caucasus, they commemorated this anniversary. And there again, dare I be a little bit controversial? After all, we are a church organization, and therefore we go on the side of the truth rather than expediency all the time, by saying that if we had people on the Turkish side and even on the Armenian side who are a little bit more predisposed toward vision and less toward ideology, then perhaps we can stand up, commemorate the lives of well over 1 million Armenians who were killed during the genocide in the most atrocious ways, rapes, deportations, killings, arrests, imprisonment. Doesn't that remind you a little bit of what's happening in the Middle East and North Africa these days? My real hope is the day will come, and I pray to God that I will be there to see it, when Armenians and Turks do not look at each other through a veil of animosity, but through one of cooperation.
I completely echo that. Well, a big thank you, Harry. I can probably assume that you're still jaded after so long in the region and in America. Just getting back to your affairs here in London, appreciate you coming in and doing a marathon there with us. And thank you to our listeners for listening in to a couple of reasonably lengthy but I hope enjoyable podcasts. Stick with us on catholicnews.org.uk for all the very latest from the Middle East North Africa region from Dr. Harry Hagopian, and we'll be with you with Middle East Analysis very soon.
Thank you, James.